Welcome to the Life Over Coffee podcast, conversations for transformation.
It is impossible to engage our culture at any level and not hear their language, including their curse words. Whether it is social media, a television show, or even a stroll in the park, our culture's words do not discriminate, and they absolutely do not care about your worldview. Because of the unending assault of their language upon us, the question that every caring parent must answer is, who is going to teach their children the culture's language? And when is the proper time to do it? Who is going to teach your child how to curse? Somebody will. That's not the question. We know that they're going to learn the culture's language, including curse words. And so every parent has to step up and determine that that will be me. Maybe I can frame this with a few relevant and practical questions about parenting children and language that will help us to reorient our minds and establish our goals regarding this critical subject. Because I'm aware that when I say something like wise parents teach their children to curse, it can catch a parent off guard and they could say, no, I would never do that. Well, how about this? Will your child learn curse words from someone? If so, who will teach your child curse words? From what context do you want your child to learn their first curse words? Who will be developing your child's theology of language, including curse words? Who is currently teaching your child a theology of curse words? Now, if they have a device, meaning a phone, even if they're 8 years old, then they're learning a theology of language. They are learning curse words. They are learning how the culture thinks and how they communicate. Our culture's words are like soldiers on a mission to redefine and reshape how we think. They're not coming for your children. They are at your children. They are there surrounding your children. They have already come. Their language has a clear-cut objective to defile and to corrupt the soul. This concept was made too real for me many years ago when our then 6-year-old daughter verbalized her joy at some good fortune that came her way. She was talking to our 45-year-old friend who was not prepared for the moment when our child exclaimed, quote, I am so damn excited, end quote. She made this statement while flinging her arms upward and falling backwards inside the side of our van. My friend's mouth dropped as she helplessly tried to regain her game face. You know, that is counseling 101, game face. Never lose game face. Maintain that composure. Well, Christine was having a hard time maintaining her composure as our adorable 6-year-old was laying out a curse word, her first curse word. That was the day I made a mental note to teach her about curse words and the rest of our children as well. It became clear that she needed a better theology and practice of language. Somehow, and I do not know how, and I honestly do not know how, she picked up on the word damn and unwittingly used it in context. All wise and discerning parents are well aware that our culture will not slow down for them to catch up. And that is more, and they are more than willing to do our job for us. Somebody will teach your child about what is right and wrong. Will it be you or will it be them? When the world inevitably knocks on your door, it would be proactively wise of you to have already introduced your children to the world. You need to be incrementally teaching them about the world. Your home is a laboratory, and you can bring bits and pieces of the culture into the laboratory where you have the control, and to appropriately, with discretion, wisdom, with courage and grace, introduce them to the world. With language in mind, here are 4 things that children need to think well about when it comes to our culture's language. Number 1, they need a biblical interpretation of the culture's words. I mean, they need a hermeneutic. They need someone giving them a lens through which they can look. And when they see the culture's words, they will have a biblical interpretation of those words. Number two, they need a lack of surprise or curiosity about the culture's words. Sometimes Christians can be giddy when we talk about, like, say, anatomical body parts. I'll talk about that in a few moments. They don't need to be surprised. They don't need to be giddy. They don't need to be curious. They need to be well established in their understanding, and you can do that while they are young. Number three, they need the courage to walk away from the culture's language. When they come, when they tell the dirty jokes or use the dirty words, they need courage and grace to say, no, I am not going to go there. I'm not going to participate. They can do that lovingly, but they can do that courageously. And number four, they need discretion when using the culture's language in relational interactions. In Ephesians 4:29, we learn a lot about how to use words. Paul said it this way. He said, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. There's so much in that verse. This kind of training begins with a transcending and overarching parental goal, which is to love God and to love others as you love yourself. That is the overarching goal, because what that does is it brings in all the commandments in the Old Testament and puts them up under two pillars in a sequential order, loving God first and loving others as yourself. As your child is learning this unique two-tiered worldview about loving God and others, you can begin laying down a sound language strategy. Now, this strategy will have three parts. Let me lay it down for you. Number one, teach your child what God's word says or implies about language. And so teach your child what God's word says about language. Number two, as you teach, you want to test your child that he's using language correctly in relational context. And so you're teaching your child, laying down a foundation. You're using the laboratory, your home, to test your child to see how they use language now in relational context. And then number three, you release your child incrementally into the world for the practical application of your teaching. So you've taught them, you tested them, and now you're ready to release them in the world. And we're speaking specifically about language. With your God-loving, other-centered worldview in place, you will be able to instruct your child to rise above the unedifying noise of our culture, to turn language training over to someone who does not believe the way that you do. It would be disobedient as a parent, and it would be unkind to your child. And so I waited until our cursing daughter was 11 years old before we began our theology of curse word conversations. Our son was 12 years old when I started introducing him to swear words. Our youngest daughter was going on 12 too. These private conversations were between the child and the parents. It was just us in a vacuum, in a context where we were talking about these things. The younger siblings, as far as when we first started talking to our oldest child, they were not part of these discussions because it was too early for them to learn a theology of curse words and a theology of language. Our children had proven themselves trustworthy in stewarding the truths about less weighty matters, and so introducing them to weightier things like our culture's language, it was not a concern for us. Again, you have the laboratory, and so you're teaching them, and they are succeeding and they are failing, and that is perfect. You want them to succeed and fail so that you can help them to work through that with the less weightier matters, and then as they mature, you begin introducing heavier things to them, and curse words were heavier things that we introduced. And we did that as they were hitting this transition time between child and adult. We were confident they would be able to steward our conversations with discretion and humility. This season is a wisdom issue that each parent will have to determine according to the season of life and the maturity of the child. As our kids were advancing to a higher level in school and also a higher level in church, we recognized the church was a nasty place too, where the culture is in the church. And I'm not saying that our children were not active participants in bringing the culture to the church, but as they were elevating to a higher level of school, grade in school, educational school, but also in church, we needed to begin stepping up and thinking about this idea of language, a theology of language. And that was motivation for us to be proactive in cultural language indoctrination lessons, knowing that they would be encountering these words with more culturally indoctrinated children. And that's really the question that you need to revisit again and again. Who is going to teach them? Because somebody will. And so we can't just put our fingers in our ears and pretend that this doesn't exist. We can't bury our heads in the sand. No, we have to step up and say, I am going to do this. And that's why I'm sharing this with you. I want to introduce to you five words. This is not the entire exhaustive cursing dictionary, but we introduced five words to our daughter when we began teaching a theology of language, and we defined these words for her. Those words were curse, cuss, hell, damn, and ass. Those were the five words that we taught, or that I taught our oldest child, and the other two as they came along later on. Typically, we have conversations like this. I use a writing device so that I can sketch them so the kids can see visually what I'm talking about. Many of you who have been following our ministry here for years at Life Over Coffee, you know that. I've always sketched out my counseling sessions. A counselee could walk away from a counseling session with 12 sheets of typing paper, white paper with sketches, stick people over it. In fact, if you go to the footer of our website, you will see a link that says Shareables. And if you click on that link, you'll see infographics. And there's over 130 of those sketches, infographics that came right out of counseling sessions. I've doctored them up for presentation on our site, but they were originally sketches on sheets of paper. And that's how I also communicated things to our children as well, particularly like in this illustration, language. And so I wrote the words cuss words on our iPad, and I asked her if she knew what they meant. She did not. She was 12 years of age. I was thankful for that. They didn't have phones at that time either. I believe she got her first phone when she was, or her only phone, when she was 16. Our other daughter was 17, going on 18. And so they did not have the indoctrination of devices. And so she didn't know what the two words, cuss words, what they meant. And then I wrote the word curse words, and she didn't know what they meant either. From there, I introduced her to the words hell and damn and ass. She asked, she said, Dad, why does damn, D-A-M, why does it have an N at the end of it? A part of me was sad because I knew I was moving her from childhood innocence to being an adult in our culture. It's kind of like a pre-empty nest vision that I was having, that I was pushing her farther out of the nest. But I knew I had to. I had no choice. She was going to, at 12, whatever grade you go to at 12, maybe 8th grade or 7th grade. And then she's also moving up in the ranks of church. And so I knew these words were waiting on her. And so it is kind of bittersweet to be able to do this. It's an intimate moment to have with your child, but it's also a kind of a bitter moment as well, because you know what's happening here and you're pushing them out of the nest. Many parents do struggle with this idea of their children getting older and leaving the nest. And I did. I've always struggled with that. It's a hard concept to accept, and even tougher to release them into the wild. However, you have to come to terms with the inevitability of life while choosing to be the one guiding them out of the nest rather than the world luring them from the nest. And that's not what you want. The world is out there luring, beckoning them to come out into the culture, to walk on the wild side. No, you want to stir up the nest. You want to flutter up the nest and push them out gradually with wisdom and caution, discretion, but with courage. We continued as we talked about hell being a place of eternal torment and how some individuals could use it as an unkind and angry response, as in, quote, go to hell. It was interesting that she did not know what a burrow was and had never heard the word ass in the context of a donkey, as we were talking about that word. I did tell her how butt, B-U-T-T, and crack were words that referred to her to ass, and how buttocks is the correct term for her, for a rear end. She was familiar with the words penis and vagina, names that we chose to use when they were toddlers. It seemed appropriate to end our first language training session with those five words, though I did let her know that we would revisit this conversation in the future as we look at more of the culture's words. The main thing that I wanted to do with her is to, I wanted her to learn words. I wanted her to learn words with wisdom and respect, discretion, humility, courage. I wanted her to think biblically about our culture's language. And so we spent a lot of time talking about a theology of language and how words began with a neutral and innocuous fact. As Cornelius Van Til taught in Presuppositional Apologetics, that no facts are neutral, meaning that we upload a lens or a presupposition for how we interpret those words. Words are made alive and given force by the presupposition, the motive, the meaning that we give them. Our presupposition is the lens through which we bring meaning to a word. Therefore, when I was a kid, I had a lens that was much different than the lens that I was shaping for our children. Motives determine how we use a word. We derive the meaning from the interpretation attached to the word. For example, the word Trinity is neutral to a two-year-old who has never heard the word in their life, have no idea what that word means, Trinity. Is it something that I ride? I don't know. Does it have two wheels or three? But after you teach the child how the Trinity is a way of thinking about God, you're now shaping their lens through which when they see that word again, they're not thinking about a tricycle, they're thinking about a triune God. The word is now becoming animated. To the God lover, it is an incredibly, wonderfully, amazingly, overwhelmingly, and stupendous word. You could use the word switch as an analogy for words. For example, a switch is just a switch, similar to the word Trinity, nothing more, nothing less. Except when my father told me to go out and get a switch from a tree so that he could beat me with it, now the word switch is no longer neutral to me. It causes me to twitch. I twitch when I think about a switch. The past abuse of a switch in my life affects how I think about a switch. You may understand a switch differently, as a utilitarian device to turn lights on and off. Though electrical switches were part of my childhood too, there was a darker, more dangerous application of the word switch. Again, all words have presupposition. They have motive. They have meaning, depending on how we are taught the words. Typically, the first person to define the word will have more influence over how a child thinks about the word. Take the word crap, for example. Thomas Crapper, he became a famous plumber in London in circa 1900. He did not invent the flush toilet, but he did invent the ball cock. And his name was on many of the manhole covers throughout London. He was known for being a plumber. His name has since become synonymous with a bowel movement. I suspect most of you have heard the phrase, I'm going to take a crap. Suppose I was a famous plumber circa 1900, and my name became synonymous with toilet paraphernalia. Maybe it is already, and I just don't know it. But today, people would say that, hey, I'm going to take a Tom. And some people would think, well, that kind of talk is crude and uncouth and unsophisticated. Don't say that around polite people. I'm going to take a Tom. Are you serious? No, there's a better way of saying that. That is so crude. And they might use the words crapper and crap, or maybe they would give a child the word crappy as a nickname. Hey, Crappy, come here. And it would not sound wrong to anyone. Someone may say, I'm going to knock the Tom out of you. And it would sound harsh, crude. Perhaps a fight would ensue if you said something like that. A few of our good Christian folk would be offended by such language, and Thomas and Tom. Language evolves, and what once was is no more. How we interpret words, the meaning, and how we use words, the motive, affects how we think about and react to them. some of the old Puritan writers talked about intercourse with God. We do not talk that way today for obvious reasons. The King James Bible tells us about bastard children in Hebrews 12:8 and pissing on the wall in 1 Samuel 25:22. But those words have evolved to the point to where it is considered archaic or maybe crass or crude to use them. And so understanding the motives and the intentions behind words, it should free our consciences to teach our children a theology of bad words. Suppose your motivations were right. Suppose your intentions were pure. If so, then you're the perfect person. You're absolutely the perfect person. Your motives are right. Your intentions are pure. You're the perfect person to teach your children bad words. You're not trying to hurt them. You're not trying to twist your child up. You're trying to free your child from cultural terminology and temptations. Is your conscience free to lead your child through bad language? Are you mature enough to teach your child curse words? I know that this is a problem with many because of Adamic shame and shaping influences and things that happen to them. They're embarrassed to talk about these words, and I'm not talking about putting them on the internet, putting them on socials, just blaring them across the speaker at your school. No, but talking to your child about them in a mature way to help them release them, to keep them from being all bound up, twisted up by the culture's language. Paul talked about giving grace to those who hear, which is a vital truth when thinking about words. Does your language give grace? Do your words build up? Are your words redemptive? Another way of say, using the word edify or to build up. Edify is the archaic word. What are you trying to export to your children? Our children learn not only the words of our culture, but what they mean, but also how and when to use the world's language. It takes more maturity to use words correctly and biblically than to use them harmfully. You could walk through any crowded public venue and realize that people do not know how to use words redemptively. They do not know how to edify one another. They know words, but they do not know how to use them to build up others. This abuse of words should motivate any parent to take the lead in language learning. If you do not teach them the culture's words and their meanings, plus the motivations behind those words, the surrogate cultural parents, meaning social media, for example, who have no shame, have no discretion, they will do your job for you. Your children will not always watch G and PG movies or live in a G and PG world. And this is a tug on all of our hearts. It's a tension in our hearts because we know what's coming. The Christian parent hopes that when the world does come knocking, their children will not be vulnerable to its temptations or its terminology, but will be able to intelligently, humbly, courageously, and wisely engage the culture while not succumbing to it. As I wrap up here, I do want to talk about this idea of worldliness because it is confusing. It's confusing in some parts of our Christian culture. In 1 John chapter 2, John says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, the pride of possessions, well, those worldly things are not from the Father, but they're from the world." You cannot talk about words without talking about worldliness. Worldliness, biblically defined, is not so much in the world as it is in our hearts. John was very clear in his first epistle about how worldliness is inside of us, not outside of us. John identifies worldliness as desires of the flesh, desires of the eyes, the pride of life. Not some object or thing in the culture. Words are not worldly things in our culture unless our evil hearts take them and make them wrong by uploading evil motives for evil purposes. As cultures and epochs change, so do our words. The careful Christian is in tune with the culture in which they live and uses words that are fitting to being a Christian in our culture. I want to finish this resource, what I'm sharing with you, by asking you a few questions that I think would be helpful as we talk about our words. And so a couple questions, a little bit of teaching here. I think it would help us, especially parents who struggle with using language with their children. And so here are six considerations for you. Number one, do not be hung up about words. Words are words. You do not have to giggle when you say penis, and you do not have to feel as though you have gotten away with something when you say the word damn. And so number one, do not be hung up on words. I trust that you aren't. If we are that way, if we lace the words that we use, the culture words that we use, if we lace them with shame or giggling or feeling like we got away with something, then, well, we're going to export that to the kids. And it will not be the interpretation of the word that you will give them alone, but it will come with this other attachments that we have with it, which is our own hangups. And so we have to make sure that we're not hung up on words. Number two, consider your audience. Do your words uplift and build up, or do they degrade and tear down? The gospel is more about others than about us. Always think of others. Never use your freedom as a right to do as you please. Some people who maybe come out of legalistic environments and they're free. I'm free. For freedom, God has set us free. I can say and do anything that I want. No, you can't. We can't. We should never use our freedom as a right to do as we please. We need to live within a proper pneumatic structure, meaning in part, we're going to consider our audience. Number three, what is your motive? When you speak, make sure the gospel saturates your heart. Let the words of your mouth come from a heart treasure that has been marinating in the gospel. If so, your speech will be redemptive. Six considerations. Number one, do not be hung up about words. Number two, consider your audience. Number three, what is your motive? Number four, are you a crude dude? Regularly give yourself a sober self-assessment. What feedback have those closest to you given you about your wordsmithing? How do they perceive, understand, and think about your speech patterns? Number five, have your words weighed. Most people will not give honest and critical feedback about the deeper matters of the heart. And so you have to pursue it. Do not be afraid to seek out your friends to serve you with their assessment of your speech patterns. And so you need to make them weigh your words, because people are afraid. Many people are afraid to give appropriate and kind, charitable feedback. They won't do that. And so if you ask them many times, they will be evasive. And so you want to gently, kindly, but courageously press the issue and say, I need your critical feedback about my speech patterns. And I'm not going to unfriend you if you tell me the truth the way that you see it. And then number six, are you an encourager? Do the people around you feel more encouraged or discouraged after spending time with you? How does your speech affect others? Are you characterized as a redemptive builder of your words? Going back to what Paul was saying in Ephesians 4:29. Now, what I shared with you on our website, you can find it, lifeovercoffee.com. It is titled, Wise Parents Teach Their Children How to Curse. It's also a chapter in our book called The Talk. The talk is about having the sex talk with your children. But in that book, I build a philosophy of getting up to the point of the practicalities of the talk. And so there's a lot more in it than just the nuts and bolts of the talk. And I want you to get this book. It is free to you. Again, it's titled The Talk. It's in our store. You can download it 10,000 times. You can have as many copies as you want, and you can share it with your friends. But part of that is one of the chapters I just shared with you, Wise Parents Teach Their Children How to Curse. Now, we had this discussion during the season that we had the actual sex talk with each of our children. Our oldest was just before 12, between 11 and 12. Our middle child was 12 plus, and then our third child was between 11 and 12. And so when we had the four-day talk, which I explain in this book, the practicals about how to do that. Well, we also had this theology of language as well. Now, there's many more words that we introduced to them. After the talk, there were more words at that point about sex, sexuality, pornography, homosexuality, etc. So there's a whole lot more words that we introduced to them that they were not familiar with at all. And again, all of this circled that season, that retreat of having the sex talk. But all of this information is in our book called The Talk. I've written it for you. It is a gift from me to you. I want you to have it. So please go to our store and you'll benefit from it. For those of you who do biblical counseling, I would encourage you to share this with folks that you're counseling, disciple makers, the people that you're discipling, mentoring. Please use this resource. It is free. For those of you that can help us to keep our resources free, I would appeal to you to consider being a regular contributor to our ministry, that you would donate. We are a 501c3 here in the States. And I would love for you to donate, that you would invest in our ministry so that we can keep doing exactly this. These resources are needful. We hear this virtually every day, how God is using these resources in the hearts of people around the world. We have a page on our site where there are 1,000 testimonies, literally 1,000 testimonies that people have just written back and said, we appreciate what you're doing. Keep doing it. We benefit so much from what you are producing. And so if you're one of the ones that can invest in our ministry, would you do that? You can do a one-time donation, or you can on a recurring basis, monthly, yearly, you can choose. But if you can help us to keep our resources free, I would really appreciate it. Go over to our store, get the book, The Talk, and let others know about it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Learn more and get access to other resources at lifeovercoffee.com.